Today on Time with Attackers, we have Joe Ferraro, co-owner of StimTech. They do all sorts of race car machining and time and aero design, and all around great guys to have involved with your Time Attacker race car project. So welcome to the show, Joe.
Well, thanks for having me.
I've always very appreciated your mindset when building a car. I feel like you look at things a little bit different, a little bit more outside the box than a lot of people that are involved with designing and building Time Attack cars. You and I were actually talking the other day about people's focus. And this is funny saying this, but people's focus on aero and not necessarily always looking at the whole package. And I thought what you and I were just chatting about the other day was really interesting because, I think you're so right at that. I think that people just get so focused on, all of the squishiness of the downforce. And I think they fail to look at other aspects of the car sometimes. So talk to me a little bit, talk to us a little bit about that and your feelings on that.
Yeah. I mean, that was actually a quite good chat we had there. We kind of spoke about, I use that example from the movie Apex there, where they're talking more specifically about composites, but where they say, they use the line, everyone seems to think that carbon fiber can solve world hunger. I get the sense all the time that in Time Attack, that's the feeling about aero, that aero can solve all of the issues and the nuances with a program or a chassis, right? And it's just not the case. Everything really ultimately has to work together. I mean, I think that, not to speculate too much, but aero can actually be detrimental to a vehicle if the rest of it is not working correctly at all, right? So it's...
I mean, even ourselves included, we were talking about the Integra, mm-hmm. and how we got down that rabbit hole of, we're trying to make absolutely all the front downforce we possibly can make. And, I take full blame for this myself, as I was failing to see that there was understeer that was in the chassis, that, and I was trying to think about it aerodynamically, and you have to think about the car on the on the chassis first and then look to the aero package. And the car was, understeering like a pig in low speed corners. And I was so focused on, we got to get the ride height right for the, the front wing to work right and everything like that. I was failing to realize this until the very final event when you came to Gingerman with us. And I kind of like had a eureka, of course, after the last lap of the year is turned. I'm sitting there going, I just figured it out.
well, I can get into the trailer quick then, at least, right?
But it's just like, it's all of a sudden we were just kind of hanging out there and I'm like, I just figured it out.
Yeah.
This car is like a brick.
Like, unfortunately with... I imagine not that, we get to work at prototype level racing ever, but vehicles that are designed completely from the ground up and they build in all types of adjustment and different settings for the aerodynamics that can be changed on the fly. A lot of those programs, when they show up to any given track on a weekend or just testing the car in general from the start, they start at the lowest possible aero settings. And they work the longest on figuring out the chassis before they dial in the aero, right? So unfortunately with unlimited Time Attack cars, they're pretty much just, well, here you go. It's everything all at once.
We'll go max boost, max downforce, and hope for the best.
And yeah, like I said this fairly frequently, like, I myself don't have much experience behind the seat of a car that's, in the seat of a car, it's 1,000 horsepower with, crazy downforce and stuff like that. So ultimately, I have to rely on any input that I put into, any program, on what the driver's telling us. Right. So it's kind of difficult.
Well, and it's something that I've even talked to Jim about, multiple times, we see a lot of people, they get very, very focused on the aero side of things. I love your analogy of saying, Time Attackers, think that kind of aero solves all problems.
Yeah.
But when you kind of look back a little bit more and you look at other forms of racing, I've brought this up with Jim, I can't even count how many times, a track that we go to pretty frequently, Road Atlanta, and you look at the times that, you know, Jim and Will and some of these, you know, unlimited class cars are running, when you put it in context with other forms of racing, they're marginally faster than a GTD car. Yeah. In IMSA,
yeah,
you know, like the lowest spec, lowest downforce, like those cars do not make a lot of downforce. They have tiny little splitters. Yes, they have lots of cool things that are happening underneath them, but you know, they're 3,000-pound cars. They don't make a lot of horsepower. They don't make a lot of downforce, but they have tons of they have tons of mechanical grip.
Yeah,
lots of driver aids, right? Yeah. And they go, you know, 19s, 20. Consistently in a 12-hour race, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And,
like, you know,
they're the aero on all those cars is designed on such a tight envelope. They don't, you know, they optimize what they can, but they don't have the leisure that unlimited time attack cars have.
No, and you look at those when, you know, like I've been to a few of the races at Motorsport, you know, where when IMSA's there. And you look at what those teams are doing, and basically, you know, the cars are going out for practice and they're immediately coming back and they go onto the scales and they're realigning the cars and they're constantly working on the mechanical grip aspect, on dialing the chassis in, on dialing the handling in. You don't really see them making a lot of aero changes. I mean, they have some adjustability, you know, obviously in their wings and things like that. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, they're focusing way more on the mechanical grip side than they are on the aero side. And the times that those cars are running are just like,
yeah,
it's unbelievable. And the fact that they can do it consistently, which is something that, you know, we definitely struggle with, I think is, you know, it's always been an eye opener for me. It's like, yeah, you know, the aero definitely can help. It can help make the car a little bit easier to drive and give you more of that kind of comfort and that ability to push a little bit harder in certain corners. But
yeah,
it's also a real pain in the butt. Like everything that we went through this past year, just trying to get our splitter to work. Mm-hmm. You know, and when I look back on it, I'm like, man, like we probably could have gone as fast as we went at any of the tracks with less aero.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we would have just gotten more time in the car.
Yeah. It's a lot of the, like any program is really just delegating the resources that you have at hand. And, unfortunately aero is definitely one of the most difficult areas, to utilize the best, I think. Just to kind of backtrack and touch on your point about the you know, the corporate motorsports, the amount of work they do on the chassis at the track. Like I myself have seen that as well. Like those teams go as far as having shock dynos at the track, and they'll look at damper data after a practice or a qualifying session and pull the shocks out of the car and, you know, revalve a set right at the track, believe it or not, and throw a different set in the car and go back out and get more data on those dampers, right? Like they go very, very far in the changes they make in the chassis components at the track. But you're absolutely right that they do not change a lot of aero at the track. Again, the cars, the prototype level cars have more adjustment built into them, but like the GT cars are pretty much just, yeah, they're just tuning the chassis the best they can. But yeah, I know it's definitely a different environment going to the GT racing versus the time attack racing, but I always just try to remind myself that they have, you know, more or less unlimited resources. Not unlimited, but a lot more
compared to what
more resources, an immeasurable amount more resources than typically available on the time attack.
And the dampers are a big one. And, you know, Jim and I have talked a lot about this. You know, we both run the K-Tune coilovers on our car. And, you know, you always have people coming to us being like, hey, you know, like, why aren't you running Penske's or Motons or whatever professional motorsports grade shocks you can get your hands on.
Yeah.
And I actually came from those. I was running JRZs for two seasons.
Sounds like me. Was I one of these people that came up to you and asked that?
Yeah, and you probably are. Everybody is, and my rebuttal to that is always the same. I don't disagree that those are amazing shocks. They are always a level above anything else. Mm-hmm. but the time and money and effort that you have to, you know, dial in those shocks. And, you know, what you're saying around, you know, I've seen it as well. Like a lot of these teams, like they're valving shocks at the track, yeah. And, you know, they're doing it multiple times per weekend. I can't afford to do that. And also, I don't really understand, you know, I'll be honest, like, I don't really understand what I would even tell somebody, yeah. Right, to make those changes. Whereas, like, I can bolt on something that's maybe, you know, 75% of the way there and works fairly consistently across a lot of the different tracks that we go mm-hmm. to. And then, you know, kind of move on to the next problem on the list, yeah. Right? And I think that's a battle a lot of us time attackers are kind of facing, right? Limited budget, limited knowledge. Like how many things can you deal with and address? And, you know, generally we wind up kind of getting to the aero stuff probably a lot faster than we should.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, the missing one, some of those other points.
The one thing you're saying about the shocks that the experience that I had. So I drove a friend's car in California, Rotrex K, Big Slicks. Ryan Novak's car, and it had JRZs on it, and he has a friend that has some sort of contact with JRZ North America or something like that, and it's almost like this thought that these cars can't make as much downforce as they do. Like when we went to Road America, and they disputed the time that we ran in the Integra, like the track disputed the time that we ran. They're like, must have cut the course somewhere, and it's like, well, no, and his contact with
were your wheels on the pavement? it's not cutting if the tires weren't on the ground, right?
There you go. But you know, the funny thing is I told him like how much spring rate we were running and how much we needed to keep the car up off the ground. And Ryan's car, Novak's car, was not the same level as aero as the Integra is now, for example. But he was running like really, really soft springs, and the thing was just. It was dragging and it was porpoising, and you know, his JRZ guy couldn't really give him an answer, mm-hmm. but he knew that he didn't really want the car much stiffer, and he didn't really like the idea of bump stops in there. And I'm like, well, what's your answer? And he said about raising the car like really high up and like letting it come back down. And I'm like, yeah, but you don't like, yes, they do a little bit of that in prototype cars and stuff mm-hmm. like that, but they're not starting the car 4 inches off the ground and letting it come to 1 inch off mm-hmm. the ground, right? And they couldn't grasp the concept that this car needed like 50% more spring rate than it had in it. Like he had this beautiful carbon splitter on the front of it, and it was just dragging and porpoising and just beating the hell out of it. And I'm like, this car needs to be stiffer, like a lot yeah. stiffer. And you know, down the road after I left that weekend, whatever, they put like a significantly stiffer spring in the car. And he's like, I can't believe how much better this thing feels. It's not dragging. It's not porpoising. It's not doing any of this weird stuff that it was doing before. And it's like, so if you have a contact or, you know, you've decided that you are going to run a Moton or a JRZ or a Penske, whoever's going to work with you on those can't be, and you know, they have to be able to think outside the box. They have to realize the crazy, you know, things that we're doing with these cars.
Can't be a street guy.
No.
No, or can't be even like, you know, like the way some of the suspension designs are in some of these pro-level cars, maybe they don't require as much spring rate, right? So you have to be able to not say, well, this car only runs 800, so there's no way you need more than 1,000. Yep. But yet he puts 1,500-pound front springs in that Civic, and all of a sudden the car is magical again. So you have to be a very outside-the-box thinker. And some of the contacts or some of the people that I've had contact with, these higher-level shock companies, you tell them what you're using, and they're like, well, no way. And it's like, well, there's no way to keep this car off the ground otherwise. You know, like we're running a 34-kg spring in the front of the Integra, and that's what it's taken. Like, you know, you're not going to keep that up with – shock compression or something like that. If it's on the ground down the back street at Road Atlanta without bumps, it needs that much spring rate. And it seems like so many of these people don't grasp this concept. And luckily, K-Tune, you know, looked to us and said, kind of, what do you think you need to make this work? We told them, they built it, and it works. We didn't have to have that battle about it.
And it's, and we, when you look at a lot of, you know, I always kind of use this as a rebuttal as well too. When you look at a lot of the really fast time attack cars, especially even in Australia, very few of them are on motorsports grade dampers. And I find that telling. And, you know, maybe they are giving up, you know, low speed grip, and there's things that they've lost there. But when you look at the podium at, you know, World Time Attack, you know, RP968, that's running on Tractive, which is, you know, a fantastic Shaw company, but they're definitely not a, you know, they're not what I would consider, you know, motorsports grade. Even Hammerhead, you know, those are, you know, they run their own shock company, and, you know, they're definitely, you know, they make some fantastic products, but they're not a Moton or a JRZ or anything like that. And when you go through the list, like, a lot of the cars kind of seem to be in that same boat. And I think it comes back to kind of what you're saying there, Jim, where it's just like a lot of these companies have a way of doing things. And they're, you know, my experience when we were working with JRZ was the same thing. You know, we were trying to, you know, ask questions and, you know, didn't get a lot of help and answers. And then, you know, we turned to kind of K-Tune, and they were like, well, what do you need us to do? And it was a very different experience, which, you know, goes a long way, in my opinion.
Joe, you know, Chris says about asking questions, and, you know, I think about questions and how important questions are. And Joe, when we came back from Gingerman, and even during that day, you had been like across the border with us before in an event, you'd been at some of the local ones, but you get so into a routine, and, you know, you get kind of thinking about the same things, you know. You're either having problems, and if you're not having problems, you're almost celebrating too much sometimes with a time attack car that you're not asking the questions. And, you know, you almost reminded me of the professor guy in iRobot. And he always is telling Will Smith, you have to ask the right questions to get the right answers or whatever. And you were asking me these questions that we hadn't really considered before. And I think that's what kind of gave us some of the eurekas that we had coming home from that event that day. And, you know, have allowed us to, like, kind of look forward to, you know, the Integra as it continues to transform and, you know, changes that we need to make and stuff like that. Cause I think we were a little bit stuck in a circle and just kind of thinking about the same things all the time. And even just something like when we talked about rear bar and stuff like that, like, you know, we hadn't tried any different rear bars or any different rear bar settings or even any different rear alignment settings in like multiple seasons. Yeah. And it's like, that is, you know, it's, you're not going to fix low speed grip with aero. You're not going to fix a 40 mile an hour corner.
Not with the aero that, like, you know, not to talk too much, but not with the aero that we're really, you know, going to be building at the level that we're working at. Like, obviously, unlimited budget cars, like formula level cars, can develop quite good aero numbers and the low speeds and all different scenarios, right? But the development costs and time and the manufacturability of systems like that are, you know, kind of outrun what we're doing at you know, our level. So I wouldn't always, you know how I always have the famous statement of not blanketing labels onto things. So I use that as a scapegoat fairly often, as you know. I would probably use that here as well. Yeah. I wouldn't outright say that aero can't aid in low speed grip. But
maybe I should rephrase it.
Definitely more. It's probably not the easiest area to work on to aid in low speed grip, I guess you could say.
And you're probably not. Even if you could, you wouldn't want to fix a car that's really understeering horribly at low speed with aero. You need to fix the understeer that's in the chassis. Yeah. And then, like we were saying before, and then start addressing the aero. Start from the no aero. You know, we should take the front rear wing
right off the car. Good.
Go turn just, a few just, laps, get it working good.
Just do that. Back on. I'd like to be there when you do that.
It would be, and not even a joke, it would be good to go to a track like TMP, underbody off, front wing off, rear wing off, and go do three sessions on some test day and get that thing kind of like figured out a little bit more and then put the arrow back on. There's no reason.
Well, I mean, there might be some reasons, but if you're into trying it, I mean, whatever, give her, right? But yeah, I mean, to your point about when I came along to Gingerman, like any technical project that's kind of worked on by just a few people, like, you know, your car typically travels with, I would say, like four people that are working, assessing, analyzing, and, you know, maintaining the car. That core group can get kind of horse blinded, if you will. And I'm talking just across all levels of technical projects, whether it's a car or something else. You know, that core group of people can kind of get horse blinded and maybe wander off in a direction that they weren't really intending to go. Whereas if you have someone else come in, and I don't mean someone else come in and just, you know, talk to them in the paddock for 5 seconds about it and they throw out a bunch of wild ideas and you think they're great. I mean, like, have someone else come in and actually be there for a significant amount of time and look at what's going on. You know, some fresh eyes can shed some light on stuff you might just be overlooking. I think that's something that
the RV trips on the way home from somewhere have been a big key thing. I think there's been a lot of discussion that's happened in this RV. I'm actually sitting here right now recording.
Think sometimes you need a little bit of fresh blood in the system, right? Doesn't hurt.
Yeah, no, you're 100% right, because it's I don't know how I couldn't see that, and I couldn't see it all year. And, you know, we've talked about this. We were able to run at a way lower rear wing angle than we thought we should be able to compared to the rest of the aero package of the car. And it didn't even really make sense until, except the fact that the car, you know, if the car is understeering that bad in the chassis, you're not going to need a crazy amount of rear wing to make that car stable. But I'm really excited that we've kind of figured that out, and I look forward to driving the car once again with, you know, a little bit more free and at low speed, and then, you know, use that rear wing and let it do its job to you know, keep the thing stable at high speed. So, Joe, you also do, you know, we've talked about this whole thing, but we haven't talked much about the aero design and, you know, some of the packages you've worked on. A lot of people will have seen you've just, just released the renderings of the DPK IAG Subaru. And, you know, I think a lot of people are interested in that. And, you know, it looks amazing. I think that I think you have a great taste for function and form. And, you know, we're really excited to see how, you know, between you and Alex from Spage kind of execute that whole build, because that's going to be a pretty exciting car.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're definitely excited for it. It's definitely a tough business to get into, doing the aero design and the complete designs especially. Fortunately, Alex has been a great aid to me in doing it. And I would say, I would bring in my point from our previous discussion here a moment ago about having fresh eyes. I'll talk about this a bit for a second, and then maybe I'll run through kind of my process that I use when doing a, but
that'd be great.
When you're doing, say, just a wing element by itself, or maybe just you know, the geometry of a splitter by itself, you're looking at a single element, and it isn't as overwhelming to produce constant improvements in that to a final point, till where you have that element creating the data you want. But when you're working on an entire chassis, it can be very overwhelming, because, you know, you can put in a 12-hour day looking at simulations of the chassis after you've spent 3 weeks drawing it, and it just is so difficult sometimes to assess the little areas and have a linear trajectory for improvement. And Alex has been very good to kind of come in and be my fresh set of eyes when I'm just like, I can't look at this thing anymore. Like,
when your eyes no longer function.
I can't look at this thing. I've hit a point where it's 80% what I think it should be. I'm kind of stuck. I don't know if I need to do a big change or just continue tweaking what I'm doing, but I'm cooked. I need to step back or do something. Alex has been very good at kind of coming in and throwing in, looking at it and throwing in ideas that are like, you know, hey, maybe you should just do this. And then I try it and I'm like, wow, like, excellent. That's kind of a good new direction we're going in. So he's been good with that. But yeah, the complete aero packages are definitely tough to do as a single person. It's something that I talk to people more frequently about as time goes on, just because Time Attack's growing and, you know, more people are putting more budget into their Time Attack programs. So naturally a lot of them want to reach for that unlimited level aero, but also a lot of them, you know, might not realize the time and the effort that goes into just the design alone, just to getting to that point, to have a design that doesn't even exist outside of the computer screen. It is an immense amount of work, and we're typically working on a very short schedule, which is also tough because to work on, I know Chris is on the coding programming side of things at one of the highest levels there is. So, you know, I'm sure he can appreciate the 12 to 16 hour days in front of this screen on a single technical task. It's definitely trying.
Yeah, it takes a lot of effort, and you know, when we talk to people at the track, it's one of the biggest things that I always try to remind people. It's just like, I don't think people necessarily realize how much time goes into the design of some of these pieces that are on the car. Like, they look simple, but at the end of the day, it's like, you know, there's probably weeks of time that just went into the design. And then, you know, once you're finished, like, the rendering that you have of the IAG mm-hmm. car is unbelievable. It looks so mm-hmm. cool. But I saw it and I was like, wow, like, that, you know, that's one of the hard parts done. But now you have the next hard part, which is, you know, you got to make all the molds. Yeah. You got to, you know, router out, you know, the 3D shapes of all the foam cores and everything. And it's just like, wow, like, that's still, you know, quite a bit of work that's left to be done there.
Yeah, right? It's number one of 72 parts, right?
Well, Joe, I remember when you had done the design for the front of the Integra last year, you and Alex working together on that, and you had like the rendering, and I was like, this is amazing. And I'm like, when do you start with when do you start getting the foam cut? And you're like, we have so much more work to do to this design to turn it into something that can actually be worked with, you know, after you have that initial design and your CFD stuff done. Like, there's so much more to it. And I think so many people, you know, when they ask about aero design, and especially if it's going to be designed to the point, you know, the TSX, we're not having things made CNC cut or anything like that with it, you know, with the design work you did on that.
It's general,
like,
ideas,
general principles and stuff like that, which is great. But when you go to the point of, okay, now we have, 17 pieces, 17 molds that have to be made. And it's like, holy shit.
It's a lot. And it's a two-sided front. The first side I would say is the obvious side. And that is the challenge in the CFD analysis in itself. So this is when you have a completed model for whatever it may be, a vehicle or just an element or some other thing. A submarine, who knows, whatever. You have to run a simulation. You have to make sure that your simulation is correlated to something known. So you have to, I like to basically take data from something that I know in CFD that has already had, you know, already has data that has backup to it, and make sure that the numbers I'm getting are kind of making sense, right? So you have to start there and then analyze what you're looking at and be able to make come up with ideas for changes to improve the design. So that's like the challenge, the first like challenge that I think would be obvious to most. And that's just, oh yeah, you're doing CFD, because everyone just says, oh, you want to do a CFD design, like, okay, yeah. So everyone just thinks you're just looking at a pressure plot and you make a decision on what to change and you know where that change should happen and stuff. But the other face of it is the raw CAD side of things. You know, a lot of people go to school, pretty much any engineer on the planet has to take CAD design on some level. And they may be fairly proficient on it. A lot of them are not, unfortunately, but it's a very big part of the challenge because the model for an entire vehicle is quite large. It's quite complicated and it has to be drawn in a way that is editable and updatable so that you can actually make changes to it when you're doing the CFD. And that's one of the hardest things, like drawing an entire vehicle from scratch and, you know, making all new body panels and elements and strakes and canards and what have you, is, you know, in my opinion, a big part of the challenge as well.
Well, when you came to the, when you came that one day when you were going to start drawing the Integra, and, you know, it's one thing I don't think people, and maybe, you know, maybe no one knows about this, but usually people either, we didn't have access to a scanner, you know, you're either starting with a model or scanning something that's already done, but you came that day with your book and you like measured all the aero that we had on the car currently, like the underbody, the side skirts, the diffuser, the wing, the hood, the, you know, the front duct and everything like that. And I was absolutely mind blown about what the measurements that you were taking. It was just unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that the Integra was a good project. Definitely tested my limits on what I could do in a day as a person. It was really like
I think those weeks last year from April to May or whatever last year, I think that tested just about everyone's.
Definitely everyone involved in the car, like myself, Alex, especially, like just, it was some major, major days. That's all I would describe it. But yeah, it was kind of a project. I mean, I remember when we first met about it, in the shop that one evening. And we kind of just decided as a group we were going to do it. I don't back down from a challenge when I like say I'm committed to something, I'm committed to it. So I was just kind of like, well, whatever we have to do to get this model done and work this out, we're doing. So yeah, I was, so then there's me with a tape measure, but yeah.
I still have a day worth of measure. I don't think people realize this. Not like 32 measurements, like
yeah, I've got like an entire notebook full of word sketches since.
So if anybody needs to know the specific measurements of a DC2 chassis, they should send you an email. Is that what you're saying?
If anyone wants the detailed measurements of the underbody, yeah. They could have that as well.
Yeah. Oh man, that's. But I mean, that's also, you know. It's garbage in, garbage out, right? So if the model is being fed by garbage data, then the output is going to be garbage. So you got to spend all your time making sure everything is 100% right, the exact way that you want it to be. Otherwise, everything you're going to gather from CFD is going to be incorrect, for sure. Right?
Well, and, you know, your CFD numbers that you had told me about, you know, the amount of frontal downforce we were going to make was intimidating. And if it was going to be true, we knew we were going to need an insane amount of front spring and front bump stop. And sure enough, we go out to Motorsport in Road Atlanta, and it is insane. Like, we're putting bump stops in and packers in and taking bump stops out and putting stiffer ones in. And it was like, you know, you did all your measurements, you knew where we were at, and you got good CFD numbers. And, you know, to me, it translated because the amount of spring rate that car required just to stay up off the ground going straight down the back street at Road Atlanta was completely insane.
Well, and it was, I remember when we were at Motorsport, and, you know, we went, Mitch and I went, and we were spotting for you at the top of, you know, turn two. And, you know, I watched you coming through there, and I, you know, I had just watched the IMSA race, you know, a month before, watching all the GT Le Mans cars coming through there. And I have never seen a non-real race car, you know, something that, you know, regular people have built, come through too and look as crazy as your car did. It was just like unbelievable. It reminded me so much of a GTD car or a GT Le Mans car, where it's like, you know, it's a lift of a throttle and then poof, you're right back on it. And away
she was
go.
Rowdy.
And it was crazy. And, you know, the CanJam, the smaller CanJam Subaru car was there, and he was kind of chasing you a little bit, and just watching the difference between your car come through too and his car come through too.
Steven Denica,
like,
yeah, his car was there.
Yeah. It was a big difference. Like, it was unbelievable to watch, right? It was
yeah. Mossport will definitely highlight a high speed aero car through some of those turns, right?
Yeah. Turn two to me is one of the best turns to see it, because you have such a good vantage point of the car. Basically, you can watch the car come down through one and then up over the hill, and then you watch them kind of drop down and scoop into three there. And it's such a perfect kind of viewing spot for those aero cars. And you know, when we watched both Mitch and I remember, you know, we both turned to each other and we're like, oh wow, that looked intense.
Yeah.
Right?
it is absolutely a perfect vantage. And the way that the descent of the hill through two is gives you an incredible sense of the speed that a vehicle has through it. And most of us have driven Mossport Grand Prix, and to understand what that speed means in turn two definitely adds context to it as well, right?
Yeah, 100%.
Like, after driving 100%. It and then seeing a vehicle go through it at speeds like that is, you know, definitely paints a picture. This was the first test day of the car, correct?
No, he's talking about in the summertime when we went back.
Oh, okay, okay.
Into the 18.
Yeah. There was no diffuser on the car actually for that when we watched as well too. Mm-hmm. It was no rear diffuser, just the new front aero, and it was rowdy.
Yeah,
that's
we were working on our new one piece underbody at that point. We didn't have that all together. So no, it raises the hairs on my back thinking how good it was with no time into it at all, and you know, all the changes we've made and will be making, and how good it's gonna be. It gets me all excited. It's a track that my family has a lot of history at. My grandfather raced there the first year it opened back in 1961, and won his class in a Volkswagen Beetle.
that's amazing.
You know, to think that we've got history in the family there that long, and to be able to have the overall time attack track record there, that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
And no, you know, and definitely wouldn't have done it, you know, going back to, you know, your work on it, Joe, and the whole crew, the whole group's work on it. Like, you know, I was just along for the ride there. If it wasn't for everything that everyone else has done, there is no way that car would have gone anywhere near as fast as that.
Right.
Yep. So, I mean, not only do you do aero design, and you know, you've been doing the safety design for, you know, Jim's car and the IAG car and stuff like that, but you also do other types of design work, and you know, one of the things you've helped us with this year was, you know, fabricating our, you know, custom brake caliper brackets. You know, you designed them basically for us from nothing. You know, what else do you guys kind of have in the queue in terms of design work that you're working on, and things that you're helping people out with?
I mean, a lot of our day-to-day 9-to-5 work is essentially projects like that. Basically, you know, the customer is looking to do something that doesn't exist off the shelf, and we have you know, worked hard at providing or building our shop to a point where we can provide an end-to-end service for mechanical parts, so hard parts basically. So yeah, we do a ton of that work. In terms of current projects, we have more or less a slew of that sort of thing. So kind of brake mounting systems, you know, odds and ends that just aren't available off the shelf yet. We're doing a fair bit of, it's kind of monotonous, but a fair bit of titanium parts right now. There's been an influx of usage of titanium in the aftermarket fabricating world as of late. The unfortunate thing is that attaching accessories to these titanium creations have not been kept up to speed in the aftermarket. So, you know, we've been making a lot of different things for sensors and mounts and bungs and whatnot out of titanium lately.
That's funny you actually bring that up. I was putting a turbo order in for somebody a week ago, and you know, Vibrant's been pushing, you know, all their titanium pieces, and there's a bunch of different companies now, and actually I finally just started to see that, you know, there's actual V-band flanges that are being made for turbos finally that are titanium for your, you know, your downpipes and stuff like that. And I was like, I hadn't thought about it before, and it was the first time that I actually saw it from Garrett directly, and I was like, oh yeah, I never even thought about that. So I bet I'm not surprised that there's a bunch of those types of jobs where, you know, someone needs a bung, somebody needs a flange made, you know, it's just kind of stupid.
Yeah, it's been a fair bit. I'm kind of like looking to the end of it, just as you say, like they're starting to catch up now. The ferrules are being made that matches up to turbos and different size pipes and stuff. Like all the fabrication component companies are starting to make all that stuff, but yeah, I mean, to be honest, I'm just kind of sick of doing titanium jobs.
Wrecking all your machinery. Yeah, probably, right?
Let's go back to aluminum, guys. It's a little bit easier for us. We do all sorts of stuff like that. Like we have, we're working on a drop-in fuel pump kit right now for Porsche that Unit 2 is building. So it's like a complete billet housing with a top cap and like the spring pin and everything that holds all the pumps and whatnot. So just stuff like that. I don't want to say we're a jack of all trades, but in terms of...
You are.
I think you really are. I mean, yeah, like, I mean, you did, you know, not only are you doing aero stuff, I mean, I know you designed our oil pan for our dry sump setup with Mitch from Unit 2, and, you know, the brake caliper stuff. I you know, we've brought you probably a bunch of different types of projects, and I don't think you've ever said no, and I don't think you've ever failed to deliver something that's exceeded our expectations. Well, so that's, you know, it's been pretty awesome.
Well, both myself and Ryan here, our background is in mechanical engineering, and prior to striking out on our own with STEM, all of our experience in our careers have been in mechanical design and manufacturing, more or less in automotive, and you know, from the aftermarket level all the way to full corporate manufacturing. Ryan spent, you know, 6-7 years as an engineer in the automotive industry, so there's not much of a car that we haven't you know, designed ourselves or been on a team in charge of designing a part or a subassembly for. So it's and I mean, the aero thing is more or less me just in front of the computer holding my eyes open as long as I can, but that's a new front. It really takes the edge off all the other work we do. Not that mechanical systems can't be difficult, because they can, but the aero makes it seem like less of a mountain to climb when we get a big mechanical project.
Yeah, it's some kind of almost like a little side project, right? Even though they're massive undertakings, kind of something a little bit different, keep the blood flowing. So if somebody has a project, what's the best way to get in contact?
Typically email. We have we're not the most social of companies on the front. We have our Instagram page, but outside of that, I don't know how to operate Facebook. I have to recover my password every time I want to log in, and that can be a challenging thing. but yeah, we have our website, which is just stim.tech, which has a contact form, which we keep frequenting our responses. And yeah, I'd say that's.
And Instagram is stim.tech as well.
Yep.
Well, that sounds it's nice when someone's got, you know, multiple places to be reached, and they're all kind of the same and easy to find and stuff like that, because you know, we've got lots of listeners here, and everyone is, you know, pretty much focused on time attack and racing and stuff like that. So you know, it'll be good if hopefully anyone, you know, wants to reach out to you guys, and whether it be machinist work or, you know, aero design, chassis stuff design, or anything like that, because you guys have, you know, done it all and done it all well. And, you know, I think that you guys would be a great compliment to anyone's racing program.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Sure. It's been a fun road. I like to always comment on the way that time attack's growing. So it's good industry. Hopefully it continues. Hopefully there's some bit of season that becomes salvageable at the end of this year, but I guess we'll see, right?
We're all hoping.
I bet you this stuff that's going on right now breeds some pretty fast race cars, because there's a lot of people that, you know, normally would be kind of ready already, or, you know, starting their season, and this extra downtime, we, you know, it'll be interesting to see what kind of craziness that breeds. So we're you know, it sucks, but at the same time, it just makes us look forward to getting back out there even
yeah,
more.
Absolutely.
Exactly. Awesome. Thank you very much. And look forward to maybe having you back on.
No problem. Appreciate you having me.
Thanks so much, Joe. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
All right, guys. Talk to you.
Thanks.